Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today is government risking the collapse of a winning export metal sector. After the G20 triumph, Kagiso Trust says South Africa must now rebuild unity at home at all costs. Cape Town tourism targets a bold new future and inside South Africa's booming health and beauty market. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of December. South Africa's proposed chrome export tax has triggered a real heated debate. The Minerals Council says the tax will do more harm than good, threatening, it says, jobs, export competitiveness, and the very mining houses that keep communities alive. And the way I see it is their argument is fairly blunt. The real problem isn't chrome leaving the country. It's the cost of electricity, crippling smelters, long before exports even enter the picture. I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council, Nzile Mthenjani. A very warm welcome to you. What is government then fundamentally misreading about the chrome value chain that makes this tax so risky?
I think it's two things. The first one is that there needs to be a fundamental understanding of the reasons why we're having ferrochrome smelters shutting, and separate that and distinguish it from the production of chrome in South Africa, despite that South Africa has a very dominant resource and reserve position in the world. And so the success of the chrome industry and the ability for South Africa to maximize its benefit from chrome is not merely forcing a lot more of this chrome ore to be beneficiated domestically. I think first and foremost, we've got to make sure that we've got the energy resources to be able to beneficiate the chrome. And where's the challenge with current ferrochrome producers not being able to continue to operate? And it really boils down to electricity.
If then electricity costs are the problem, why is policy obsessed then with restricting exports instead of fixing energy pricing? I'm sure that's a question that you've put out yourself. What answers are you getting?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we haven't received any answers, but one should perhaps look at this thing also from the global perspective or the regional perspective, where with South Africa and chrome being a critical mineral and the whole global conversation about critical minerals and supply chain risk, most governments that are in a position of advantage to supply any of these critical minerals are talking beneficiation. And most of them actually are not in a position where they've got the adequate energy resources. And so there's a lot of coercing that they'll need to have of potential miners and beneficiators working together to beneficiate in country. But South Africa is fortunate to be a lot more advanced, where it has had beneficiation capacity, and it's about how does it maintain it and grow it, rather than looking at what I feel at times is a short-term opportunistic argument of trying to force beneficiation at a time when there's increasing demand for these minerals. My view and the view of the Minerals Council is that we need to take a medium to long-term perspective. We've been talking about beneficiation for a long time, and we do need to look at whether we've done anything about it since the whole concept of strategic minerals was introduced in our legislation. And so a medium to long-term position where how do we fundamentally change the landscape for South Africa to play a better role of beneficiating its minerals? Creation of a domestic market where we don't beneficiate merely just to be able to sell higher value products, but in fact these metals are actually used for infrastructure development, a reindustrialization of the economy. So I think we also have to think through beneficiation, not only from a global supply, but I think a domestic need as well for economic growth.
But isn't the export tax, in theory at least, a useful tool to boost local beneficiation?
So, I mean, it can be, but it needs to be within a well-informed industrial policy. And we haven't seen the argument for chrome tax in that context. So I think to the extent that there's a belief that there's more chrome being exported than should be beneficiated, despite that the conditions for beneficiation are appropriate, I think perhaps in that context it would make sense. But there are a few key missing pieces for that policy to make sense at the moment.
Is there hard evidence that the smelters have collapsed because of power costs and not simply because they were becoming structurally uncompetitive anyway?
Absolutely. And I mean, and those are two important issues. Firstly, in terms of competitiveness, we've had challenges with electricity supply for the past 10, 15 years since that mysterious bolt was found in one of our generators, right? And we've had load shedding for a significant amount of time. It's really been in the past 2 to 3 years that we're beginning to see ourselves out of this situation. Now, in that time, China has built not only electricity generation capacity, but also ferrochrome production capacity. And they've done it in a manner that actually has made their ferrochrome production much cheaper than ours, largely because of the electricity. Now, they obviously have a different, you know, policy environment in terms of how they invest. And so this is where, to the second point, the evidence comes in terms of competitiveness, that China produces ferrochrome. I think the last estimate is about half of what we produce just from electricity perspective alone. Now, to introduce a chrome tax to try and make it more expensive for us to for China to acquire chrome, whilst it may work, I think the success of that strategy is not proven or tested. In the meantime, there could be an impact where the actual mining of chrome may also be affected, let alone the beneficiation, whether the beneficiation will come through.
Which then, I guess, begs the question, how big is the job loss risk?
Absolutely. And so, you know, we've seen the unfortunate job losses which could potentially be recovered in terms of ferrochrome, but you don't want to extend that risk to the actual mining, because it could be a challenge to restart the mines, let alone restarting some of the ferrochrome production.
So I'm sure you have an alternative intervention on the table. What is it that would strengthen both mining and smelting, but Mzila, without distorting the market in any way?
Yeah. So there have been conversations between the ferrochrome producers and certain departments in terms of a potentially favorable tariff that will make them more competitive. And I think we've been waiting for that announcement to come forward from government. So I think that will resolve this issue of beneficiation, ferrochrome beneficiation reopening, and we hope that it will enable most of these smelters to reopen. The second part is that if we get all the ferrochrome smelters to operate, we have to acknowledge that there's been a lot more chrome produced in South Africa than there is capacity to beneficiate it. How do we maximize the benefit from both? We are adding value to chrome, but I think this is how we need to be wise in our own advantage of the mineral endowment that we have, that we can produce a lot more chrome that we have capacity. We can build additional ferrochrome capacity over the years. But in the meantime, let's export as much as we can, as well as beneficiate as much as we can, because out of those two scenarios, we're maximizing the value of our exports and the revenue we gain from that.
Thank you very much indeed. Mzila Mthenjani, Chief Executive Officer of the Minerals Council. Appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as you heard President Ramaphosa saying earlier this week, South Africa's successful hosting of the G20 has been hailed as a moment of rare national unity, a demonstration that the country can lead, convene, and deliver on the global stage. But where to now? Well, the Kagiso Trust says this achievement shows what's possible when government, business and civil society pull in the same direction, but they add a challenge. The same discipline and collaboration has got to be applied in fixing our big domestic crises. So let's discuss that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of the Trust, Dr. Mankodi Moitse. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. You've praised the G20's performance. What exactly did we get right that we don't get right at home more often than not?
Look, we see the G20 summit not just as a diplomatic milestone for South Africa, but it really reminded us that we are a nation that is capable, especially where there's clarity of purpose, clarity of goals, that we can work united. And it really reminded us that when leadership is required, they can really stand up and really lead with decisiveness. Jeremy, the level of collaboration that we have seen is a level of collaboration, a level of engagement that we really require to deal with the issues that the country requires. So we think as Kagiso Trust, we are set and ready as a nation to really take this beyond the G20 summit.
The problem, of course, is we are sporadically capable. If we can deliver excellence under global scrutiny, why does that capability, in your opinion, disappear when the spotlight moves?
If you think about it, Jeremy, the amount of energy that went into galvanizing the country to be ready for G20, the clarity of the message from leadership, from government, it was quite clear that everybody knew what needed to happen. I think currently, if you look at it, there are so many issues that need to be resolved or dealt with in terms of the South African context, that at the end of the day, they get lost into, we are not clear what is a common vision and purpose that we want to achieve. We think that given the clarity of mission that was defined, if we do the same thing with the coming dialogue, Jeremy, I believe that South Africans will be able to stand up. But the other issue was the level of inclusiveness was at another level. It was government, it was business, it was civil society. It didn't feel like it's just for the elite. Of course, I mean, civil society could have still been engaged even at a bigger level. But we think that if we bring all parties to the table for an authentic engagement, South Africa is able to take the challenges to the next level.
That's a very lofty proposal, and you talk, Dr. Moitse, about unity of purpose. But my question to you then is, where is that unity, in your opinion, currently breaking down here at home?
Yeah, that is a challenge. I think over the years, Jeremy, we all know that the voice of communities, the capacity of civil society has really not been centered in the programs or the activities that have been happening in the country. Active citizenry has really not been the feature that have defined the South Africa we are in at the moment. And I think over time, that capacity was eroded and it still keeps being eroded. We think and we firmly believe that when we work with communities for them to participate and not be beneficiaries to the challenges that they are facing and co-create solutions with them, not only do we get something that lasts, but people protect what is being pronounced. People become solutionists. The reality is that no level of government, no level of business can reach every street in South Africa. But civil society and communities are really there to make sure that they protect, defend, and even bring solutions that you and I cannot be able to bring because we are not at the coalface of the challenges of poverty, unemployment, GBV, you name it. So we think that this moment of going beyond the G20 summit and say, hang on, right now, next on our watch, South Africa, is the national dialogue. How do we bring the same energy, the same excellence, the same listening to each other? Jeremy, people were working nights and nights without being paid, by the way. Those declarations were produced by people who work during the day and at night, hundreds and hundreds of meetings, as the president was reporting, were happening. So we really believe that we are up to the challenge as South Africans.
Dr. Moyetsi, those same sentiments that you have outlined existed post the Soccer World Cup 2010. The idealism, the enthusiasm, the optimism, and that all faded away to nothing. What makes you think we can do it differently this time?
This time, we don't have a choice. You see, with 2010, there were other options that were being bandied around to say, if South Africa can't, we can go to another country. This time, if South Africa doesn't work, where do we go to? I think right now we've reached a crossroad. I think we all want a solution. So I think right now we are at a point where we feel it's now or never. And I think that my view is that it's a strong, strong message, a strong motivation to say, let's collaborate and let's bring sustainability and excellence in the kind of things we want to do. But also, I mean, congratulations to the president. I think the kind of leadership that we saw with the G20, if it comes and if it's expressed as strong and as firm as the way it was with the G20, I believe as a nation, we will listen.
Thank you very much indeed. The Chief Executive Officer of the Kagiso Trust, Dr. Mankodi Moyetsi, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Cape Town's tourism sector is booming. $24.5 billion in visitor spend, record airport traffic, and global rankings that keep rising. Now there's a refreshed Cape Town Tourism Board. It's unveiled an ambitious plan, expand the levy base, harness artificial intelligence, and push for something bold, a tourism job in every household. Well, is that achievable? I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of Cape Town Tourism, Enver Dumini. A very warm welcome to you. So let me pick you up on that. One tourism job in every household. It sounds very inspirational. But is there hard evidence that makes that achievable and not just a slogan?
Thank you, Jeremy. Yes, it's absolutely aspirational. And I think that's what we need to do. But I do think it's achievable because I think if you look at the performance of tourism, and it's one of the fastest growing sectors still within South Africa and in Cape Town particularly, along with the BPO sector, we've seen significant growth in jobs because of also the growth in demand. And currently I know that tourism has about 106,000 jobs in Cape Town. That's about 7% of the employment. And what we are referring to is that it's not just about the direct jobs, Jeremy, but it's also about the indirect and induced jobs. Because again, with indirect jobs, people have to supply the tourism sector, whether that's everything from jet fuel through to food, through to services, whether that's even a print and a copier being required by a tourist guide or tour operator. But we mustn't also forget that the people within the tourism sector themselves will also spend within the economy. So that's also the induced effort. And that's why we talk about a tourism-related job or opportunity that we believe that our demand generation and, of course, the success of the GVA, the gross value add that tourism contributes to our city, is something that we want to push and push harder.
It's all a question, though, Enver, of social parity. Visitor spend is rising. That's well documented. But how quickly can that be not only converted into real jobs in the poorest community, but making sure that it is evenly spread? What do you think is blocking that right now?
Well, Jeremy, I think there's a few things blocking it. The first one is that, of course, we require bigger infrastructure and more advanced infrastructure. And if we look at what the airport is now going to be spending about, I think, 9 billion rand on its infrastructure, of course, that allows us to also do a runway to get A380s. And that will increase both efficiencies for airlines, but also grow the demand. And I think for every 10 tourists that come to our city, one job is created. So it is a demand-driven activity. But also what's critically important is that, like you said, it's how do we make sure this geographic spread and that the benefits don't only go to a few, but is spread across the city. And that's why we do a lot of community-based tourism. We work with communities to make sure that the product and the experiences are not only affordable, but also world-class. And then, of course, making sure that those spaces are on the itinerary, not just for a visit, but also for stayovers. And that's something that we pride ourselves on as Cape Town Tourism that we drive. But how we do that is also by bringing in artificial intelligence and technology, not just from making sure we have AI itineraries, but also looking at how we can work with partners like Google to start training up the future AI experts to assist the tourism sector, which can come from our communities.
No one says that you mustn't be chasing growth. That is critical, and you have record arrivals. But Enver, what is going to stop that from tipping into a crisis? I'm thinking water security. You've had that problem in the past. Congestion, environmental pressure. Do you have your eye on the balance here?
No, absolutely, Jeremy. I think this isn't just growing for growth's sake. It is about balance. And what Cape Town Tourism, along with the City of Cape Town, have developed is five future scenarios up to 2039, understanding that tourism needs to grow responsibly, it needs to be inclusive, and it needs to be accessible for persons with disabilities as well. And that's why what we do is we work quite closely with the City of Cape Town. If we look at all the infrastructure developments, the growth and the investment there, but also the city has what you call the resilience team, which focuses on the impact of different sectors, the growth in the economy, the semigration, and finding a balance. This is, of course, not perfect, but it does require us to collaborate as the sector, as communities, as well as local government, to make sure that we can have balanced growth. But also is the fact that when you look at the percentage of growth or our percentage of arrivals compared globally, we're only scratching the surface, and there's so much more that we can offer that allows it to do accelerated growth, but of course making sure we balance that with significant infrastructure development, skills training and development, but also making sure that, that tourism is accessible for all communities.
You're using the word balance a lot, and it's the all communities which is critical. You keep winning global praise, but it would seem to me the benefits cluster in the same high-value areas. You don't really have a plan, do you, to break that pattern?
Jeremy, that's where I disagree with you. I'm not quite sure what research you were looking at, but when you look at the engagements that we have with communities, the Future Leaders programs in tourism, the Limitless Cape Town that focus on persons with disabilities, actually running their own businesses within tourism, coming from disenfranchised communities, this is all part of that plan. We may not be kind of pushing it at all or at like 120 kilometers an hour, but these little increments that we are making is beginning to change that narrative, but also how we see ourselves as a destination of being inclusive. You know, the challenge for us is, of course, is that tourism is not the silver bullet to all of this. It does require a lot more collaboration between both communities, private sector, and government. So Cape Town Tourism, as a not-for-profit that's been around for about two decades now, where we sit is between government, industry, visitors, and community. And that allows us to play quite a strong facilitation role, but also a leadership role in finding the ways that these different segments traditionally would not connect. But we use tourism as the vehicle to connect them. And of course, to make sure that we do transformative change with tourism. I would recommend, and I would actually challenge you to come and hang out with us into the communities, into the schools, and see all the work we are doing to make sure that tourism is accessible, that it is inclusive, and it is transformative.
And fundamentally, Enver, it's all about the money. You want to expand levy collection. How do you do that without inflating prices, squeezing margins, or driving small operators out of the market?
So that's a good question, Jeremy. And if you look at what the Thompson levy that's been announced since 1999, in fact, it's the visitor that pays for it. It's 1% on your bill. And in the rest of the world, that number sits between 5 and 15% if you do travel. And the 1% is still significantly way below, but it's not for an operator to pay. It's actually just to be a collector from a visitor, and it's voluntary. So we're not forcing people to say that they must become collectors. It's just another way for us to say, how do we grow the pie? Because the amount of collectors, when you see the Thompson numbers, is only a fraction of the total market that is available within the tourism sector to become collectors. So what we're saying is, if our job as Cape Town Tourism is to grow demand, let us allow the visit to pay for it. But of course, it is optional. So we don't want to force people. It's not a tax. So we need to also find ways that we can grow our revenue, because unfortunately, our funding from government is also shrinking. And we need to be mindful of that. And so we can't always place the checkbook at government's door and saying you must fund tourism completely, and the industry is not doing their fair share.
Enver Dumini, Chief Executive Officer, Cape Town Tourism. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I read that South Africa's health and beauty sector is exploding, not only in complexity, but also value. Worth an estimated 108 billion rand next year. It's being reshaped by changing shopper behavior, more assertive private label growth, and a path to purchase that increasingly begins online long before anyone actually walks into a store. So let's discuss these shifts and what they mean for brands fighting to stay visible and relevant. I'm joined by Andrea Slubber, Insights Lead at Trade Intelligence. Andrea, always good to talk to you. Your report shows health and beauty heading towards 108 billion rand. That is a big sector. What's driving real growth?
You know, the health and beauty industry has really seen great growth based on consumer sort of needs. Even before the pandemic broke, wellness has been established as one of the key shopper needs and consumer needs in South Africa and globally. And if you look at the behavior and mindsets of especially the younger generation, in embracing wellness and beauty, it certainly speaks volumes in terms of products that they would purchase to support their health and beauty needs.
And consumers, particularly that younger cohort, have become a lot more savvy. I also read that 89% of shoppers are researching before they're buying, and almost 100% among younger consumers. Is the shelf becoming less relevant, do you think, than the search bar?
The shelf is still very relevant, but in many cases, a product choice is almost confirmed before somebody goes into a store. That's particularly relevant in terms of healthcare and for beauty products and personal care. However, what we also see at shelf point is particularly in personal care and beauty, shoppers are really interested and consumers are really interested to see what ingredients are in a product and also excluded. You know, the sort of trend of clean label, people wanting to see that a product is, for example, free from harmful additives or preservatives and do contain the ingredients that they want at the right levels. So a lot of that still happens in store in terms of browsing between different products. But yes, online searching, I mean, if you look at how we have our phones in our hands, we've got access to information from the brands, from experts, you know, beauty experts, healthcare experts. So a lot of pre-shop research determines the brands that consumers will use.
That is so interesting. So it's being used both as a planning tool, but also a discovery engine. So are brands then, do you think, under-investing in the digital influence that all of this provides?
Many brands are actually investing in that. I think if I could distinguish between health and beauty a bit, from a healthcare perspective, the recommendation is that brands really make their products visible and educate healthcare professionals on the benefits of the products and the credentials and the quality, etc. Because a lot of recommendations lots of consumers seek healthcare advice online. So whether it's a registered healthcare provider or perhaps healthcare representative employed by a brand, the information and advice shared online is definitely welcomed by South African consumers. And even in store, there are advisors that help you to make a product purchase in store. So there's opportunities for brands to do educational drives with those in-store personnel.
Andrea, let's talk about private labels surging, particularly at one outlet Clicks. Do you think national brands are losing the trust battle or the price battle or maybe even both when it comes to acceleration like this?
I would say the price battle is most relevant. A trust battle is definitely not going on. I mean, South Africans love their favorite national brands, and there's deep trust entrenched in those products. But, you know, shoppers have been forced to relook their shopping habits. Our income growth has been outpaced by the growth of the price of our grocery basket and the basket of health and beauty products that we buy. So many people don't want to exit a particular wellness or beauty or healthcare category and then seek affordable alternatives, often in the form of a retailer brand, a private brand.
So if we focus on Clicks, private brand share, I read, at over 30%. Surely at some point, this shift starts to change supplier power dynamics.
Absolutely. It is a big pain point for brands and suppliers in South Africa. Sure, there are some South African suppliers that manufacture for the retailers, but your brand equity, all the work, years and years of building brand trust and brand presence is certainly eroded. Not the brand trust that's eroded, like I said before, but it is a big challenge for brands to remain relevant to their shoppers.
So if it comes to a Clicks or a Dis-Chem, for instance, brands have then, if I'm hearing you correctly, got to start rethinking the way they do promotions, given that those two outlets serve a very different mindset to supermarkets, for instance.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's another side to it, but let me just look at established brands first. I mean, that's where educational drives with beauty practitioners and healthcare practitioners can actually benefit a brand's relevance to the consumer. However, I must also add that the South African health and beauty retailers like Dis-Chem and Clicks, in particular Clicks, have invested in initiatives to allow smaller new entrants into the market, new brands, new product ranges that are locally created and manufactured. So from a brand perspective, you know, those are often sold as exclusive brands only available at that particular retailer, or in select cases then produced as a retailer confined label. So for the small players, there are opportunities. For the big players, it's a big uphill battle.
Fundamentally, those supermarkets remain, if I've read this report correctly, what you term grocery first missions, which means that health and beauty in that particular channel is permanently stuck in an add-on territory, or is that changing as well?
Sure, they are. I mean, if you look at shoppers fulfilling their grocery shopping at a supermarket, most of them actually prefer to buy particularly their beauty products and not high-end beauty like cosmetics, but more your personal care products. Mm. They actually prefer to buy their personal care products in the supermarket for that benefit of the one basket shop. So we actually see a big proportion of health and beauty products because of the big sort of share of personal care in one's basket being purchased at supermarkets.
Well, a fascinating insight. Andrea Slabbe, thank you very much indeed. Insights Lead at Trade Intelligence. Appreciate your time. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.